From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
How would you translate the word gezellig?
In English, cozy. Very cozy.
Cozy? Comfy?
Something between cozy and fun. Warm.
Neat? Sociable?
Cozy or snug.
Pleasant? And party atmosphere.
How would you translate gezellig?
I wouldn't translate it because it doesn't exist in foreign countries, just in Holland.
It's a typically Dutch word, so you can't translate it in English. Gezellig. Try to pronounce it. Gezellig.
Gezellig.
Shame on you.
That's tricky. There's no translation for gezellig.
Can you know a culture if you don't speak the language? Can you know about Asian food if you've never left North America? Can you, with your modern mindset, read a centuries-old story and really get it? And what if you're a lifelong Republican or Democrat? Can you hear, really truly hear, what the other side has to say? In this cross-inter-multi-cultural age, we're surveying the map of global culture, attempting to see what's lost or made new in translation. Think Paris. After the Eiffel Tower and the Champs-Élysées, what comes to mind? The croissant, the baguette, the bonbon? Food is certainly the most palatable expression of culture and the most easily shared. LA Times food critic Jonathan Gold has spent his career seeking out the best plates of authentic or reinterpreted culture. And Strange Champs asked him about food in translation.
So I was thinking, Jonathan, for people who love exploring other cultures, one of the most visceral ways to do that, of course, is to eat. And even if you can't afford plane fare, many of us who are lucky enough to live in medium or large cities can kind of take a little trip to another country just by hitting the right restaurant. But I think that maybe most of the time the food that we're eating has actually been subtly translated for North American appetites. Would you agree?
Of course it has, or at least in most of the country it has. I know in Madison, for example, and they have some Laotian restaurants that are fine, they're decent. But Laos is a poor country and it has a sort of cuisine of poverty. You know, they eat every leaf and every sort of herb, you know, tiny scraps of meat because they can't afford more. It's a specific kind of bitterness and of spiciness and of sort of herbaceous quality because that's what they can eat and that's what they can afford to eat. And so if they've, say, transplanted themselves to Madison in the middle of American abundance into a landscape where people perhaps can't tolerate bitter and spicy and herbaceous flavors like that, of course the flavors are going to change.
What about you live in L.A.? Do you find in a city like L.A. there's less of that translation going on?
I think there is. The reason L.A. is different from most cities in the country, I think, or maybe any city, is that, A, it's very spread out. B, we have enormous immigration. So Los Angeles has more Salvadorans than any city but San Salvador. There are more Koreans living here than there are anywhere outside of Korea. And the neighborhoods are insular enough that I find that a lot of those people and a lot of those restaurants are cooking for themselves rather than cooking for non-Korean or the non-Mexican that might be walking through the doors.
And how different does that make the food then?
It makes a huge difference, I think. In New York City, for example, which also has huge immigration, say you have a Korean restaurant that's in a Korean neighborhood. They're mostly cooking for Koreans, but still they take the subway every day like everybody else. And they're always rubbing shoulders with people who aren't Korean. And as a result, they're probably thinking a lot harder about what non-Koreans might like to eat. Whereas here, they don't. You know, Mr. Kim goes into a restaurant, he wants to eat exactly what what his mother used to make him on Thursday afternoons when he was growing up, and he's able to find that. And we're able to go into those restaurants and eat what Mr. Kim is eating.
What do you think are the most egregious sorts of mistranslations of food, that ethnic food that you find in North America? I mean, food that's kind of been dumbed down, essentially. I mean, I think of, I don't know, that gloppy marinara sauce you find in Italian-American restaurants.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of the Olive Garden. But in a way, Americanization of foreign foods is legitimate in its own way. Cuisine is never stable. It's never fixed. It's always changing. And the ideas of what are authentic are always changing.
I mean, we're sort of assuming in this maybe kind of snobbish way that Americanized food automatically means it's not as good. It's not the authentic, real thing. It's inferior. It's been dumbed down. But sometimes, surely, an Americanized version of something actually takes on a life of its own and becomes good.
Well, of course, things are authentic to regions. One of the things that I write about a lot is Mexican food in Southern California. We've always had a substantial, you know, Spanish-American or Mexican-American or plain Mexican community. And there are the sort of foods that people describe eating in the ranchos in the 19th century that you can still go into some restaurants here and find, you know, the beans cooked a certain way, the marinated and grilled meats, the chicharrones. And there's a well-developed sort of Chicano cuisine, and it's what people grew up on. And then there's the second set of immigration. They identify with their village in Michoacán or coming from Guadalajara or coming from Zacatecas or coming from Oaxaca, because there is this sort of quote-unquote authentic or more specifically regional food that a lot of people who are sort of in the second stage of Los Angeles connoisseurship tend to dismiss the older places as inauthentic. And in fact, it's authentic Los Angeles, California cooking. It's just not authentic Zacatecas-style cooking.
Are there any cases where an ethnic food has been Americanized and then returned to its place of origin and gotten popular there?
It happens all the time in Korean cooking, for example. For example, there's a kind of tofu stew called sundubu, which is a kind of jjigae or soupy stew or soupy or stewy soup that has lots of chilies and usually sort of a fish broth and then freshly made tofu, and it's served at the table. And it's sort of always been a dish here, but then it became faddish, a really popular dish in Los Angeles in the 80s, and it went back and it became a fad in Seoul. Mm. Even with Italian cooking, I think. I was with a chef friend, Nancy Silverton, about 22 years ago in northern Italy. We went to this sort of horrible folkloric restaurant. Among the many bad desserts we had was something they called panna cotta. And you could have played highlight with this and you could have bounced it. It was a super ball of a dessert. But Nancy is the genius pastry chef of all pastry chefs. So when she got back to California, she tinkered with it. She tinkered with it. She took out most of the gelatin. And she figured a way to, like, just barely set the cream so it was, like, rich and trembling. She started serving it on her menu. And it spread as a fad first across California, then to New York. Then it came back in Italy. And panna cotta is a really popular dessert there. And Italians, of course, will tell you that they've always had panna cotta, but I can tell you they didn't have good panna cotta. That was Nancy.
That's a great story. So then in the 90s, there was the fusion cuisine trend. Remember when the very first, say, French Asian or Californian Asian restaurants were coming about? But in the meantime, fusion's kind of gotten a bad rap somehow. Was there something chefs were getting wrong in those efforts, do you think?
Well, there are a couple stages of fusion. The first stage of fusion was Japanese chefs cooking French food. Then Wolfgang Puck, you know, probably the first celebrity chef in the country, opened a restaurant called Chinois where he cooked Chinese food a French way. It was funny. All of his Chinese chefs quit really quickly within the first month because they refused to cook their food in this crazy way. This Austrian chef cooking French food was telling them to do. But it became it became really popular, and the food was really tasty. Soon, the idea of fusion became, you know, a lot of chefs go to cooking school. They're reading cookbooks. They're looking at things. They see flavor principles. And they were doing things like making Thai noodles without actually having driven the 20 minutes to the restaurant that served actually a really good version of it. But what we're seeing now, I think it's exciting. I think it's the new big trend in American cuisine, which is chefs from mostly an Asian background but occasionally from a Latin background who are exquisitely trained in French cuisine coming back and cooking their own food, the food of their heritage, the food they grew up eating, but informed by all the technique that they've gotten from working in French restaurants.
The message of what you've been saying is that that's kind of where it's all headed. We're going to have layer upon layer of translation, and things will have gone back and forth from one continent to another. In the end, we're going to wind up with this sort of global cuisine or mishmash, and it'll be hard even to decode the origins.
Oh, yeah. I mean, already there are these incredible triple carom shots that I just absolutely love. For example, the kind of taco that is the most popular in Los Angeles now is something called al pastor, which is pork usually that's highly seasoned and cooked on a spit. But al pastor comes from central Mexico, where there was a lot of immigration from the Middle East, especially Lebanon. And al pastor, of course, is their version of shawarma. Or there's this chain of incredibly popular seafood restaurants here that are Vietnamese shrimpers from Houston cooking Cajun-style seafood for a largely Cantonese teenage audience.
You know, listening to you talk, I realize this is what you are. You're a food translator in a way yourself.
Well, thank you. It's what I try to do. If there's anything other than like describing food that I do, is try to get people to be a little less afraid of their neighbors.
Jonathan Gold is a restaurant critic for the LA Times, and he's the author of Counterintelligence, Where to Eat in the Real Los Angeles, and Strange Champs talked with him. You can hear the extended version of this interview and dig through our archives for a banquet of foodie fun on our website, ttbook.org. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. You know, a picture's worth a thousand words. That's why we thought it would be fun and educational to publish a comic book to go along with our upcoming series, Meet Your Mind, A User's Guide to the Science of Consciousness. We'll explore some heavy subject matter in a new way. Go to ttbook.org to watch our video about the making of the comic book and find out how you can help.
We have a variety of names for this homemade whiskey in this county, the White Lightning. We call it Cold Juice, Conversation Wood, Sweet Spirit to Catch a Fightin', and Rucus Juice, Corn Squeezins, Firewater, Snake Oil, Rattlesnake Juice. Pop Skull is another name for that very bad liquor. Uh-huh. You can get a little high on it, and the next day your head feels like it's going to split wide open and fall down on each shoulder.
That's a little tape from the archives of our friends at the Dictionary of American Regional English. Just goes to show how language can change from state to state, even from town to town. Of course, it's not just geography that defines culture. It's shaped by language and class, clan and family. It's also shaped by time. Today, our cultures are fundamentally different than they were one or two or three generations ago. If we want to understand old cultural artifacts, maybe we need translators. Ruth Calderon has been studying Jewish texts and stories since she was a child. In her book, The Market, The Home, The Hearth, she reinterprets them for contemporary life.
Could you tell me a little about the background of these stories that you are reinterpreting?
Yes, these Talmudic stories, they are very short miniature stories that were written around the 4th or 5th century in Babylon by rabbis. And it's not completely clear why they were written, but they are spread out all through the Talmud, which is mostly legal. And between the legal talk, there appear these little short stories, and they usually give you some kind of depth to the conversation that was on the page.
So they were written by rabbis, and who is the audience? Who is reading the stories?
They were written by rabbis for rabbis. These are not popular stories. They can be fully understood only by people who know rabbinic culture well, because the words are not just prose, as we usually speak. The words are very concentrated. They are very symbolic.
Well, maybe we could talk about one of the stories, and I was thinking of Rabbi Love. Can you tell me the original story and then your reinterpretation of it?
Yes, of course. It's going like this. Rabbi Love was sitting in front of the big rabbi, Rava, in Mechoza, which is a very famous Ivy League kind of yeshiva. And he used to come home to his wife every Yom Kippur evening. One day, the study was attracting him, and his wife was waiting, saying, "Now he's coming, now he's coming." He did not come. Her mind weakened. One tear dropped from her eye. He was sitting on the roof. The roof broke under him, and his soul rested, meaning he died. It's very unclear in the first reading, I think.
My understanding is that actually in rabbinic law, the rabbi is required to come back to his wife at least once a year and to engage in sexual relations. And partly this is what the wife is waiting for.
Yes, it's a very interesting way of thinking about it. In the rabbinic culture, the side that needs to offer sexual and intimate relationships is the man. They are very aware of the fact that women need intimacy. Now, in this story, we see someone that is called Rabbi Love, and we expect him to be a professional lover and someone that understands in intimacy. And we find him coming home only, and they have this cynical read here. They say he used to come home every once a year. So I think they are mocking him a little. And usually he comes home at the Day of Atonement, which is the day that in Jewish culture you ask for forgiveness. And when she would forgive him again, he would again go back to the yeshiva and again leave her alone and study. That specific year, he was attracted by the study. And he said to himself, "Well, I'll come tomorrow." Now the storyteller tells us that she is sitting and waiting in the Aramaic. The words, "Now he's coming, now he's coming," sound like hashta'ate, hashta'ate. You can hear her breath waiting for him, hashta'ate, hashta'ate. And then there's one line that says, "He did not come, lo ba." And then she breaks down and she lets one tear drop from her eye. Now we have a kind of a split screen. On one side of the screen, we see a close-up of this beautiful woman and the tear drops from the eye. On the other side of the screen, we see a man sitting on the roof of the study house. And when she lets the tear drop, the roof below him breaks and he falls at the same pace on the other side of the screen until he gets to the ground and dies.
So the quick reading of this would be that he is so wrapped up in his rabbinical studies that he forgets about his wife.
Exactly. And when he's sitting up there on the roof and he's studying below the stars and feeling very lifted, very close to God, he's not aware of the fact that the roof or the building he's sitting on is actually his wife. In Aramaic, a wife is the same word for a home. If her heart breaks and she can't hold anymore, everything that he feels in his career that is so high up and so successful will fall with her
Now, your story, your interpretation of this story comes from the wife's perspective. It's very much right. A woman's point of view. Is that the way the story has traditionally been interpreted?
I'm afraid not. It's a new thing that women study Talmud. I think it's a very valuable new perspective to think, what was she thinking? She doesn't even have a name here. The rabbis of our generation or the generation before us did not study stories so much. They used to skip them and look for the legal stuff.
Can you explain how these stories would be used in the Talmud, how they are edited into religious texts?
Yes, that's a very interesting question, because like when you pet a cat, you can stroke the cat's fur with the fur and against the fur. In the same way, you can read it with the fur. So they will say a man has to come to his wife once a week, but he's also allowed once every 3 months, and this is the law. And then they put this story, and the story strikes you against the fur, saying it is allowed, but it's very cruel and it's very dangerous. So it's not like in legal books. This is not an example. The ruling says one thing and the story says actually the opposite. And together you get the full Torah, the full learning.
I'm wondering how you see what you're doing with this kind of interpretation of the story, how it fits into the ancient tradition of exegesis, of interpreting these Talmudic stories. I could imagine that a lot of traditional rabbis would say, hey, wait a minute, you're reading too much into the story. Do you see it that way, or do you see what you're doing as part of the long history of exegesis?
I feel it is a part of a long history of interpretation. Jewish culture is in constant change all the time. I believe that when I read, I try to read it clean and try to understand what the writer has put in this story for me. Usually when people like traditional rabbis today or ultra-Orthodox rabbis, if they would come to me and they would doubt my reading, usually when we sit together and read the actual text, we become closer than other people that would live my way of living but will not read the Talmud. I feel that the Talmud is necessary to my life, and I must find a way to make it relevant for me and to make my life relevant for it.
You have founded an institute that has brought together artists to work on and interpret these Talmudic stories, and I assume that they have come up with their own interpretations. What are some of the most exciting reinterpretations you've come across?
Some of the most exciting work, there's now a new show by Adi Ness, who is a great Israeli photographer who is showing all over the United States. And he did a series of biblical images with the homeless people. That is great work. There's a musician called Kobi Oz who recorded two albums while he's reading this ancient text, and he interpreted it in his own kind of rock, pop kind of way. David Grossman, one of maybe our best living writer today, he has been studying with us since the first time I established an institution, Elul, and David Grossman was studying and is still studying every week. And in his books, even when he writes a novel, in the language, you can see that he's studying.
Is this important in Israel in terms of trying to bring together the secular side of Israel with the Orthodox religious side?
I believe it is very important, but I'm not sure that Israel today, it's a little bit avant-garde in a way that the majority of secular Israelis do not see yet that these texts are very important to them, and they usually leave them to the Orthodox. Although I believe it's an important thing to build a deeper culture and to make our life much richer, and also to have a base on which we can, very different people can live together, because we share the same cultural language, the same heroes, the same insights. So I believe it's important, and I also enjoy doing it very much. It is my passion. I love my work. I hope one day it will also be considered important.
Ruth Calderon is the head of culture and educational programs at the National Library of Israel. She's also the founder of Alma College in Tel Aviv. Steve Paulson spoke with her. Coming up, Japanese musicians take a liking to American pop music, and a psychologist weighs in on the culture gap between Democrats and Republicans.
The president is the high priest of the nation, and the Republican Party and conservatives more generally are just constitutionally better suited to play that religious role. Democrats are more likely to treat it like a policy question, and that's not really what presidential politics is all about.
But first, for some of us, culture shock doesn't only come from traveling somewhere utterly foreign. When writer Josh Swiller was growing up, he often felt outside his home culture. Frustrated, he decided to leave the U.S. altogether.
I was a Peace Corps volunteer in the bush in Zambia. It was a day's travel away from phones, roads, electricity, running water, toilets, and toilet paper. I was there to dig wells. The village really needed wells. They drank right from the river, and a third of the kids under the age of 5 died of waterborne disease. A year into my service, I had not dug a single well. I tried everything. Information sessions, flattery, begging. Nobody wanted to help me. They were afraid of me, actually, because of a big man in the village, a power broker, a witch doctor. He didn't like me. I guess he saw me as a threat. I set up a meeting to ask him for help. My friends in the village helped me prepare for this. They said, "Josh, here in the bush, we have something called the snake in the grass. When you're asking a favor from someone with power, you don't ask directly. You weave your way around, you flatter, you take your time, like a snake approaching its prey." I came from a different school of diplomacy, the New York City school, the having three brothers bigger than me school, hit first and hit fast. But I told my friends, okay, I'd try their way. After all, I was a cultural diplomat. Before I tell you about the meeting, there's one thing you should know. I'm completely deaf. I can't hear a thing without hearing aids. As a kid, I had 12 years of daily speech therapy to learn to speak as well as I do. And I do speak well. I speak so well, people don't know I'm deaf. I speak so well, people don't see how hard it is. They don't know that I feel outside of all the rules and mores of culture. It doesn't matter to me whether you're culturally polite or impolite or white, black, red, or on fire. To me, all that matters is that I can understand what you say. In fact, all the rules just make it harder, and I got tired of it, and I joined the Peace Corps thinking I'll go someplace so far away, so different, that culture won't matter. And so at the meeting with the village power broker, I wasn't obsequious or flattering, as my friends had suggested. I didn't respect the cultural rules. Instead, I lost it. The big man's behavior seemed so unfair to me. That's all I focused on. I told him he was hurting his people. I called him a liar and a thief. "Josh," my friend said, "he will put a curse on you." "Yeah," I said, "sure." Two weeks after my blowout with the big man, I was in an old school bus on rough Zambian roads. I got a seat over the rear wheel well, where the floor comes up a couple feet. That seat's fine if you're in the sixth grade, not if you're 6 feet tall. After a few hours, I walked to the front of the bus, found a kid, and asked him to switch seats with me. He wore a blue tie. He was dressed for school. All these years later, I can still see his nervous expression. When else in his life had a tall white guy ask him to move, he switched without hesitation. I couldn't get that well dug, but I knew enough about Zambia to know that children do what adults tell them, just as women do what men tell them to do. God knows why. It's culture, right? So I was respecting it. Also, I was tired. In the previous 2 weeks, I'd caught malaria and nearly died. I'd been robbed. You might even say I was cursed. 5 minutes after we switched seats, the bus swerved off the road. It bounced wildly through the undergrowth and then swerved back, but too fast, and bam! Slammed on the ground at 65 miles an hour. I came to covered in broken glass and blood. I scrambled out where the front windshield had been under a jet of spurting oil, stood there in shock. And when I looked back at the bus, I saw 15 men standing against it, pushing on the roof. Pushing it upright? That works with a Volkswagen, not a bus. But they pushed and they pushed, and then one of them reached underneath and pulled out the boy. The boy in the tie. The one who had switched seats with me. I ran back. He was unconscious, but still alive. His chest was heaving, but it looked more like a jigsaw puzzle than a chest. And there was nothing we could do but stand around him and watch him die. So, you know, you think culture doesn't matter. You can't hear it, and it rushes past. It's all complicated. You ignore it, and then it comes at you like an angry avenging angel. You respect it, and someone dies because of that. And all you ever wanted was to do the right thing.
Josh Swiller is the author of The Unheard, a memoir of deafness and Africa. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Sushi, shoji screens, samurai. America has a thing for Japanese culture. And since the U.S. and its allies occupied Japan after the Second World War, some Japanese have had a thing for American culture, music in particular. Michael Burdash explores how tunes were traded across the Pacific in his book Sayonara America, Sayonara Nippon. I asked him when he first fell in love with Japanese pop.
It goes back to my own first experience in Japan. I went in 1984 when I was a senior in college. I lived in the men's dormitory at the university there. And I felt listening to music there that I'd walked into an alternative universe. All of the kinds of music that I knew, whether it was new wave or funk or pop or R&B, I was hearing, but the artists were all different. Recorded a lot of it on cassette tapes to bring back to America to have my friends listen to them here. And when I did that, I was kind of disappointed by the results because my friends couldn't hear the same things in the music. They couldn't get the same kind of pleasure out of the music that I could. The beginning of the book was trying to write a map for people that come from a different place that would allow them to approach this music, which, I mean, there's so much great music coming out of Japan.
Adaptations began, what, right after the Second World War?
Well, my book starts right after the Second World War, but you could go back earlier than that. Certainly in the 1930s, there's a big influence of American jazz music and dance music. American music since about 1939, 1940 had been officially banned in Japan as the enemy's music, but people still remembered it quite fondly. There was also a strong desire to move in a different direction. There was a universally shared recognition that Japan had followed a course that had led it to ruin. And American music represented one of the ways to move in a completely different direction, hopefully towards something better.
It's this difference in the cultures that's kind of fascinating. A YouTube link you sent was of the Tokyo Boogie Woogie. If you're not paying too much attention, it looks like it could be any big band show. And then all of a sudden, it is and it isn't.
The composer of that song, a man named Hattori Ryoichi, was actually in Shanghai during most of the war, doing musical propaganda reviews. In a music store in Shanghai, he accidentally came across the score for the song Boogie Woogie Bugle Boy. He was very familiar with American jazz and dance music, but recognized there was something new going on in this song. And so he started experimenting with it And that was the song that sung by Kasagi Shizuko, where it just really all came together. And it seems it was enormously popular in Japan, of course, but it also seems to have been very popular with American soldiers in Japan at the time as well.
Did it have to be changed to make it appealing to Japanese audiences?
You know, I don't think it did. I mean, the lyrics are in Japanese, of course, but I think what was really appealing was how international and cosmopolitan the song sounded. And the lyrics of the song really reflect that. They're about joining the world's music.
Do you think that the fascination with American music was a desire to become more like the U.S.?
I mean, in some ways it was. It's a really complicated issue. And you know, certainly a fascination with American popular culture, American television programs, Hollywood, the teenage lifestyle of the United States were all attractive to listeners. But conversely, sometimes the music that was really popular and attractive to Japanese was music that seemed to be critical of mainstream society in America. So folk music is an instance of that. African-American music that was critical of American racism in the 60s and 70s was really popular in Japan. The United States was in some ways a model for things that Japan seemed not to do well, democratic values.
Was there a flip side? Was there a part of Japanese culture that was horrified at the intrusion of American pop culture into their society?
Absolutely. Contact with an occupying army is always an ambiguous thing. The presence of Japanese women who were dating or sometimes selling sexual services to American servicemen was really controversial, and this music was closely identified with that. So it was. There was a reaction against it at the same time as there was what the historian John Dower calls an embracing of it.
You were fascinated as a young man when you went to Japan for the first time at this music that seemed so unfamiliar to you when you arrived. I wonder whether there isn't something Asian about the way in which the music changed that takes a little while to become used to. I was thinking about Terry Tarachi's shamisen versions of Surf Rock.
Yeah, he has a lot of fun working in really disparate genres of music, including traditional Japanese folk genres into rock instrumentals. There's been all sorts of really interesting and fun and sometimes bizarre experiments in combining genres. I mean, there are elements in Japanese popular songs today that sound to our ears Japanese, although it's also important to remember that what sounds Japanese to us today isn't the same thing that would have sounded Japanese to someone, say, 30 years ago. Those codes that we use are constantly in flux. One of the things that I always enjoy doing is looking at where different artists are categorized. There's a big J-pop section where, of course, contemporary hit music is. And then there are other sections called things like Enka or Kayo Kyoku, meaning more Japanese indigenous genres. And artists move back and forth between the categories. And I'm always fascinated that someone who 10 years ago sounded like contemporary pop music now sounds like they belong to a different category.
There are other American tunes that sort of found their way into Japanese culture, like G.I. Blues, the Elvis Presley hit. It's funny listening to it. They do actually say and sing, I think, G.I. Blues. But the rest of it is entirely in Japanese.
Yeah, that became in the 50s and 60s kind of a standard way to appropriate Western hit songs, to translate the lyrics into Japanese, but to keep the chorus partly or wholly in English, to retain the tie to the original. G.I. Blues is a really fascinating instance of a song. It was recorded by a number of Japanese artists in 1961. Different translations do different things with the lyrics. In the book, I talk about Sakamoto Kyu's recording of the song, and one of the things that's fascinating about the Japanese language translation he uses is that all references to Germany from the original English version of the song disappear. And it seems to me that in doing that, the song is sort of relocated to Japan and to American GIs who were stationed in Japan at the time.
Things continue through the spectrum, don't they? And I wonder whether any of it came back. I was listening, for instance, to one of the links you sent to the folk albums that the Japanese put out in the 60s especially.
Yeah, folk music is interesting. You know, in Japan in the late 60s, it became enormously influential in student demonstrations and in underground culture. Cover versions of the same songs that were popular in America were recorded in Japan with Japanese lyrics, or new original compositions in the same style were produced. But it was really important in the folk genre to sing in Japanese. It was one of the ways that you showed that your music was authentic. In some ways, it seems paradoxical that this music, which is so clearly imported, became one of the places to show that one was authentically Japanese by singing in Japanese.
The back and forth is part of what's so fascinating about it all, isn't it? There was a back and forth between Japanese and American musicians, too, wasn't there? The Sukiyaki song, for example.
Absolutely. Sakamoto Kyu, right around the same time, recorded a song in Japan called Ue o Muite Aruko, which could be translated as something like I'll keep my head up as I walk. And it was a pretty big hit in Japan in 1961, but then kind of faded from people's memories. But then it was resurrected under a new title, Sukiyaki, and became an enormous worldwide hit, including a number one hit in the United States during the summer of 1963.
Are there other examples of American music, a U.S. musician, for instance, being influenced by Japanese rock or pop?
You know, I think there are traces of it here and there. Lots of American artists have included elements of Japanese music in their compositions or references to Japan. And there certainly have been cover songs of Japanese pop songs recorded by American artists. But I think, you know, there certainly is a trade imbalance.
This is consistent with your initial experience, isn't it, when you first went and came back all full of enthusiasm for Japanese music and played it for your friends? They weren't interested.
Absolutely. And both American listeners and Japanese listeners tend to have a certain kind of blinder on when they come to the music. And there's a preconception that Japanese musicians performing in genres that are identified with America are somehow inauthentic or copies, and that the original lies on the American side of it. But all popular music is, you know, adaptations and translations and appropriations of pre-existing music. And that's as true in Japan as it is in America.
Michael Burdash chairs the Department of East Asian Languages and Civilizations at the University of Chicago. His book is called Sayonara America, Sayonara Nippon. You can find his list of links to more Japanese pop through our website, ttbook.org. With all this thinking about crosstalk, we started to wonder what gets lost in translation here in the U.S. The first, the most glaring, and perhaps most important divide that came to mind was the divide between the political right and left. Social psychologist Jonathan Haidt told Steve Paulson why Democrats and Republicans seem to speak different languages.
My sense is that your analysis of the political divide has very personal roots. You say you were a solid liberal, at least until you really started looking into the underlying moral values of liberals and conservatives, which made you reevaluate your own core political beliefs. What happened?
Well, I guess you could say that a lot of my research has been driven by moralistic anger or even hate. I came to political consciousness during the Nixon and Ford years, spent my young adulthood hating Republicans, watching as the Democrats seemed to just blow it in election after election. In 2004, I actually turned to politics in part because I wanted to help the Democrats understand about conservative morality. And as I got deeper and deeper into it, I realized that they are actually right about many things, just as liberals are right about many things.
Well, you actually go further than that in your book. You say that Republicans understand moral psychology and Democrats don't.
Well, that's right. I think most Democrats, if they look back on the sorry state of the party over the last few decades, will shake their head in agreement with that. The Republicans have just done a much better job of making appeals to the gut, making appeals that resonate emotionally rather than cerebrally. And politics, like so much else in life, is not a matter of calculation. It's a lot more like religion.
You're saying that we actually develop our core beliefs not through rational deduction. We don't sort of work it out in our head and figure out what's right. Mostly it's some gut reaction, and then later on we justify it.
Well, that's right. You need some first principles. You need some pole star. And as much as we might want to think that we steer by our own moral compass, the findings in social psychology show that we are much more like lemmings than we are like mavericks able to do whatever they think right. We're not very good at reasoning to weigh up all the pros and cons and decide which policy will yield the best results overall.
So what does this have to do with politics then, and specifically the way conservatives as opposed to liberals approach politics?
Much of my research has been to map out what are the taste buds of the moral mind. We find that liberal cuisine tends to rest most heavily on care or care, harm, compassion, suffering, all those sorts of issues, with also a fair amount of fairness and liberty, where liberty is fighting against oppression. So there's a set of moral concerns, and then policies grow out of that. Conservatives have all of those moral taste buds. They're not quite as compassionate, not quite as bleeding heart, but they have some others that liberals don't use as much, especially group loyalty, respect for authority, and a sense of sanctity or purity.
So you're saying those moral messages stick more with conservative voters?
You can trigger quite a lot of anger on both sides. But one of the unique things about national politics, the president is the high priest of the nation. And my view is that the Republican Party and conservatives more generally are just constitutionally better suited to play that religious role. Democrats are more likely to treat it like a policy question, and that's not really what presidential politics is all about.
Well, if candidates should not appeal mainly to the policies that they are espousing, what should they appeal to?
Well, let's take the central issue of this election. We're in huge trouble in this country. We are so vastly overspent. We've got to cut a hell of a lot, and we've got to raise taxes, and we've got to do more cutting than raising. Now, the Republicans come along and they say, well, we're going to do it all with tax cuts. And I think that's crazy. You can't. But Obama should be saying, we've all got to give here. We're in big trouble and we've all got to give. This is what great leaders do. Winston Churchill didn't come in and say, I promise you that 98% of you won't have to suffer when we fight the Germans, but the other 2% are going to give blood, sweat, toil, and tears. And Obama has been saying, we're in big trouble here, and don't worry, everyone, I'm going to protect all of you, but we got to raise taxes on the rich. That is a divisive appeal. I wish he would say, we've all got to give, and that means the middle class too. Think of it as though there's a button buried deep in our heads, which is the, we're in big trouble, cooperate as long as everyone else is cooperating. That's the button that Obama isn't pushing. It's a button that Bush didn't push after 9/11. So it's a bipartisan failure to appeal to our better nature, I think.
So as you lay out these different mindsets, do you see yourself as a kind of cultural translator, showing people how they can talk to each other, how they can talk across the political divide?
Yes, that's exactly what I'm hoping that my book will do. We try to confirm whatever it is that we start off believing, and we're always able to do that. So the only way that you can think well is if you can have other people on the other side to disconfirm your pet theories. Our thinking, our good thinking, requires talking openly and listening to people on the other side. All these good ideas that you never even were exposed to because you're locked in your own sort of your own gated moral community.
And yet, it's so hard to talk across this divide. I mean, people are more polarized than ever. How do you break through?
Well, first, let's just note things were really, really bad in the 19th century. I mean, leading up to the Civil War and afterwards. There is precedent in our history, and we've gotten through it. The danger is that now, for the first time in our history, the parties are not coalitions. Parties used to always be coalitions of interest groups. Now, for the first time, we have a perfect psychological split. All the people with a liberal personality and liberal values that go with it are in one party. All the people with a more conservative personality or disposition, actually libertarian and conservative, those two dispositions, are in the other party. And that means that for the first time, the people in the other party really are different. They think differently from each other. They value different things. They're really different cultures. And that's dangerous because it makes it extra easy to demonize them.
Well, and it seems to me that the task here, I mean, if we really care about civil discourse and ultimately about a healthier political scene, is not just to beat the people we don't like, but to figure out how to talk with them and meaningfully.
That's right. And that's why I think the way to do this is to think about indirect methods. There are some efforts that try to bring people together over food. Food is one of these deep things. When you eat with people at the same table, it activates ancient circuits of trust. You're saying we are like family. So I suggest indirect methods focus on relationships first and then gradually introduce policy questions or other political questions. So rather than just coming at them saying, why do you believe X if you also believe Y? And that's the standard form of political attack. Rather than that, if you go and you say, conservatives are really concerned about personal responsibility, you know, tell me about that. Do you see both parties as fostering that? And if you make that sort of opening, which shows that you're not attacking, you're trying to understand, you often are met with a reciprocal gesture in which, say, you know, your brother-in-law might say, yeah, you know, the Democrats, they've always been against personal responsibility. But then he might soften him and say, you know, on the other hand, the Republicans, you know, so the way they bail out the banks, they haven't been so good on it either. So you got to get reciprocity and acknowledgement working for you. Don't just recreate the normal form of political engagement, which is a fight.
Interested in new ideas when those ideas are expressed in well-selected words.
That's Steve Paulson talking with Jonathan Haidt. His book is called The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion. You can hear more of Haidt talking about legislative politics and voting against our own interests on our website, ttbook.org. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website, where you'll also find a wealth of past interviews with great thinkers, creators, and agitators. If you want to keep an eye on what's on our minds, follow us on Facebook or Twitter. You can buy a copy of this program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for Crosstalk. Thanks to our friends at The State We're In for making us feel gezellig. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Sarah Nix with the help of Veronica Rickert, Anne Strainchamps, Charles Monroe Kane, and Doug Gordon. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.